Let's start the show like real men.
That's right, ladies. We're going to be like real men.
That's right.
Uh-oh.
So crack a window because it's going to smell in here.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Sneaky Dragon. My name is David Dedrick.
I'm Ian Boothby.
And today we have a special guest. Actually, we're down here at Emerald City. I guess we should point that out so everyone knows where we're located for this particular episode. And our guest today is Alec Longstreth. Now, Alec is a longtime comics artist. He's worked, been in zines for a long time. He's a teacher at
CCS. For Cartoon Studies.
Thank you. Center for Cartoon Studies, CCS, in White River Junction, Vermont. A rather remote place, I believe, but we can hear about that from Alex. Alex does a great comic called Phase 7, and he just published a fantasy adventure called Basewood, which he worked on for many years and had quite an ordeal. So we'll talk about that as well. And he's also a pinball enthusiast and does a magazine called Drop Target Zine. So
that's all the time we have for the show.
So thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's been a treat. Anyway, next time on the show, we'll plan this out better.
I should have timed the introduction. You're right. Next time.
That's okay.
It won't be an hour long.
That probably is.
I thought it was rather good.
No, it was a very good introduction. I think that is the longest introduction we've ever had, though.
Well, I got a lot of stuff going on, so you know, you got to dig into all of it.
It's great.
Absolutely,
it's great. So, well, I just want to go. First thing I want to say is how I first heard about Alex, which is kind of interesting. Because it wasn't the comics that it was actually, I was reading an interview with Aaron Renier. I'm going to call him Renier. Who did Spiral Bound, which I'm sure everyone knows, and also the pirate comic that Alex colored. That's right, the Walker Bean, which I bought it, read it, and then gave it to my nephew, so I don't have it to reference, but it's worth giving it to kids because it's such a fun adventure story.
Yeah, one of my favorite comics ever.
And so I was reading this interview with Aaron, and he was talking about the schedule that he had got from his friend Alec Longstreth, and it had a little link, and so I clicked on it, and it brought me to your website, and it had this schedule, and I was like, this is amazing that you took the time to figure out a drawing schedule for your comic, you know, and I guess you did it to show how serious you were about that you wanted to draw comics, and so you created this schedule.
Yeah. So I was unemployed at the time in Portland, Oregon, and I just kept sending out job applications and all this stuff, and it wasn't working out. So I said, until I get a job, drawing comics is going to be my job. Because I think as cartoonists, sometimes you'll get a day off and you're like, oh man, I'm going to get so much work done tomorrow. And then you sleep till 11 and then you're checking Facebook. And then, you know, pretty soon the day's gone and you've drawn for 2 hours.
Amazing, like podcasters as well, actually. It's amazing.
But I thought it's sort of like, it's sad because you talk to people and they're like, oh, I didn't get any comics drawn this weekend, but you know, I have my shitty day job where you have to show up at 8 because otherwise the boss is going to be on you and say, where were you? You're 15 minutes late or whatever. And I thought, well, if you can't take the thing that you love and you're passionate about and treat it with that much respect, then, you know, what good are you? So I started waking up early, looked at the clock. I got to sit down at 8, start drawing, draw until noon. You get an hour lunch, back to work, you know, draw from 1 to 3, take a little break. You know, the breaks start getting a little longer as the day goes on. 3 to 5, take a break, back to work. 5 to 7, listening to NPR. That's when NPR came on in Portland. 7 to 10 is your longest break. The breaks are getting longer. You know, take some dinner, maybe talk with your friends a little bit. Go on a date or something, then say, oh, sorry, I'd really love to hang out, but I got to get back and draw some more comics. And then you draw from 10 to midnight. So,
I imagine the space between dates gets longer as well.
Yeah.
I'm just picturing like an old-timey 1950s boss, you know, yelling at you at first, and then you go, I'm ditching that guy. And now you're that guy.
Yeah.
You got to pick up a cigar and just yell at yourself
brain,
in the mirror.
Yeah, my brain is a 50s boss. Back to work, Longstreth.
Yeah. That's right.
So, yeah, and I was able to do that for 4 months, nonstop, 7 days a week. And it ends up being, if you're awake, the key element that most people don't realize until they get a little older is 8 hours of sleep, right? Mm. When you're 20, you're like, oh, you know, I've been up. I only got 2 hours of sleep. And you're trying to sound cool to your friend, and he's like, I'm still up, man.
I've never slept.
Yeah. And you're like bragging, I only need 4 hours of sleep. You know, you try to brag to your friends. And then at some point, you're like, this is insane. I'm going to get 8 hours of sleep. And then that leaves 16 hours. And that schedule is 10 hours of working, 6 hours of break. And I found that that's pretty manageable. So
do you still math follow adds that? Up.
Let me say that much.
No, I do not still follow it. You should take that. That's part of a lecture called "Your Comics Will Love You Back." And on the last page, it says, "Take this whole lecture with a grain of salt." That was like when I was unemployed, had nothing going on. I was 22 or whatever, and I was living in Portland.
Yeah.
So now I have many freelance responsibilities. I'm married. I have friendships. So, you know, I probably draw like 2 to 4 hours of comics a day.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Oh, good. All right. I was getting
worried. And that's enough to get me through. But yeah, it's funny because I give this lecture every year at CCS, and every once in a while there'll be like a crazy student. This year it's Luke Healy, who's working on this very ambitious thesis project. And so he was like, "I'm doing Alex's schedule." He was one of our low residency students. So he was in Dublin, Ireland, actually.
Okay.
And he was working on it. He said, "I'm doing Alex's thing because I'm at home. I don't have any distractions." And so he was drawing 10 hours a day. And, you know, God bless him. I think he got a lot of work done. But there's more to life than drawing comics.
Do you have an idea in your mind what your your average page production was during that time period?
Well, that's when I started working on Basewood, which was an absolute nightmare.
That's really
so we can get into that, but Basewood pages are not good things to measure anything by.
Okay.
The motto of Basewood is never again. I'll never do anything like I did on Basewood. That's what I learned by drawing Basewood.
So,
the pages are huge and very detailed. Right. And so it's like a Basewood page takes 40 hours to draw one.
Do all your adventures end with like, take this with a grain of salt, never do this. Okay, clearly this was a mistake.
Well, I think all of life is like that.
Exactly.
You know, like, you know, I teach at CCS and I say, here's how you should do it. Don't you dare do computer lettering. You need to hand letter. If I see one of you pull out a laptop, I'm going to rip your head off. And then I say, but take that with a grain of salt. You know, maybe computer lettering's for you. Or
that's 1950s boss talking.
Right.
And
right.
He's scared of the computers because they fill a whole room. They get very hot.
Yeah, he's up in my head. Sometimes he takes over. No, but I just think, you know, in life, you get all kinds of advice and it's up to you as an individual. You know, you can't change other people. You can only change yourself. So you get advice, you listen to a lot of different people, and then really at the end of the day, it's you make your decision. Is that good advice for me? Is that not good advice for me?
And some of it, I mean, if you really took that seriously, you just kind of end up disappointing yourself because it's hard to maintain a 10-hour-a-day drawing schedule.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like with Dave Sim as well, you know, you have to produce a page a day,
mm-hmm.
which, you know,
it's, and that was a huge part. If you read that lecture, yeah. Dave Sim was like sort of the mm-hmm. impetus for that whole thing. The other one I do is draw comics every day.
I have read that lecture.
Yeah, watered down version of Dave Sim's draw a page a day.
Yeah.
Because when you read his manifesto, it says draw a page a day. And then at the end of 7 days, if you don't have 7 pages, look at your life. You know, and he's like, you know, if you have a girlfriend or a wife or children or pets, you got to make some hard decisions. We're reading this going like, what? You know, like, I'm not going to make the decision to
kill my cat.
Right. Or whatever.
That cat's taking too much time cleaning the litter box.
Yeah,
it's to go.
Talk about a grain of salt. How about like a truckload of salt when you're reading that?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, Dave Sim is someone who was happily married and had tons of friends and whatever when he started Cerebus.
Yeah.
By the end of it was sort of, you know.
An isolated hermit.
Yeah, isolated hermit. So you can see what that lifestyle does to you.
Yeah.
You know, and I have lots of respect for Dave Sim, and Cerebus was a very important work for me. But,
yeah.
So, you know, that's like something where I was like, I like the intensity. I'm an intense guy.
Yeah.
And I admire that. But then it's like, how about draw comics every day? So on the most insane day, I draw a 24-hour comic. That's 24 pages in 24 hours.
Sure.
And then, you know, on the worst day, I'll open my sketchbook, draw 2 panels, and it's like an eye closed and then an eye opening. You know? Ta-da! I drew comics. See you guys later.
Scott McCloud.
That's all I have. Yeah, that's all I have.
Or you just call up Scott. You happy now, Scott?
And usually it's
who
an
is
eye,
this?
Yeah, it's an eye open and then it's closing going because it's the end of a long day. But yeah, you know, I do think that piece of advice, like, keep your foot in it every single day, pops up everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen blog posts where Jerry Seinfeld said, if you want to be a comedian, write comedy every day. Take a wall calendar, make an X every time you write some stuff each day. And
that's right. The 10,000-hour thing.
Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell's. Is that what it is?
There's actually a Jerry Seinfeld thing online now where he actually shows you how to do it with a yellow legal pad. And it's interesting. Yeah, he just breaks down his whole process. It's on YouTube. It's well worth a watch. Yeah.
Also worth a watch is the Turtles' History of Their Management, which is how not to do it. So that's another one they do quite interesting. But I just want to talk about Basewood because that's a really interesting story. So you started your comic, or your, let's call it a comic.
Okay.
Phase 7. And partway into Phase 7, you started to incorporate Basewood into that.
Yeah, so basically I had the idea for Basewood in 2000. I had I went to Oberlin College in Ohio. I had the most boring class you've ever imagined. I had this horrible teacher who shall go unnamed, but she literally would put on a video, which is already insulting at a college level course. Yeah. Be like, watch this video. One time she put on the same video 2 weeks in a row, and we all said, it was on for 30 seconds, and my hand shut up. I was like, excuse me, professor, you showed us this video last week. And she was like, oh,
All the other kids are like, Alex, shut up! Yes. We didn't get enough homework, man. Shut up, Alex!
And she said, goes, well, try to look at it differently. And then it was she was out the door, and the door slammed, and it was just like, oh my god. So I'm just trying to stay awake in this class, and I came up with this idea. What if a guy woke up in the middle... start the story in the middle. The guy wakes up in the woods, his shoe is missing, his head is bleeding, and then from there I have to figure out the rest of the story. But that was 2000, but I didn't know how to draw.
Yeah, okay.
So when I started Phase 7, that was 2002 when I graduated, because I was publishing stuff in the school paper at Oberlin, didn't have anywhere to share it, so it sort of started my mini comic Phase 7.
Yeah.
But so Basewood didn't start till issue 5. So really the first 4 issues are me figuring out how to use my comics materials, how to tell a story, how to write dialogue, all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until issue 5, which was 2004, that I felt ready.
You kind of went through, like everyone who starts Ian did too. Ian started a mini comic called I, and the first issue is very detailed. All the drawings are trying to be very realistic. And then about 3 comics in, everything's simplified down. You figured out your style and,
I started with a big epic story. Of course. Meanwhile, this little side story of some autobiographical stuff and some, maybe I just do the autobiographical stuff.
Hey, this stuff's easier and more fun.
Yeah.
And all your friends say, oh, I like that one I was in.
Some of them.
Some did not. Some actually had relationships break up because of things I put in there. I felt bad about that.
Wow. Did you say, well, it's not called you. It's called I.
Who's the important one here? So you started. Now, of course, you found Basewood so work intensive.
Yes.
That you ended up kind of skipping ahead with your issue numbers.
Yes, happened a little later, but I guess if there are any cartoonists listening to this, to my voice right now, the main mistake, the main mistake I made is that I didn't know how to draw small. Okay, that was the real mistake I made on Basewood, because I wasn't comfortable drawing small, because like you're saying, when you start something and you first draw it really realistically, and then eventually you realize that's not what comics are.
Yeah.
Right? Comics is a simplification of real things.
Yeah.
So, drawing small is a simplification of the simplification of comics, right? Because you can't fit all the detail in a nice big drawing down to a tiny drawing.
Yeah.
So 4 inches was about as comfortable as I was drawing a full figure. And then I said, okay, well, if I want a 4-tier page, that's 16 inches, and I probably need a couple gutters and then some margin space. So I went down to the arts and crafts store and I was like, oh, 24-inch paper, that looks great. So I bought these huge sheets of paper, 18x24, and then I started drawing. I was like, oh yeah, that looks great. Or whatever, I guess that's it. And then, 200 pages later, please kill me.
You did a lot of cross-hatching.
Cross-hatching, stippling, anything you can imagine that takes textured, time. Yeah. So literally all I'm doing in Basewood is covering huge 12-inch by 12-inch, a square foot of real estate with stippling and just sitting there and tapping the pen against the page for hours and hours and hours.
And now the other thing that you did was, I guess you decided in the sort of moment of monk-like fervor to shave off all your hair off your head,
yes,
face. And just not cut it at all.
Until it was done.
Until you're done. And you started that, how many years after you decided this did it take you to finish?
Well, so chapter one came out in 2004. So that was when I was living in Portland. I finished the first chapter and I moved to New York City.
Okay.
And I felt like I had hit a wall. So I went back to art school.
Okay.
And that's when I did the thing you were talking about where I sort of put a pause on, I worked in New York for my first year just as a temp and I drew chapter two.
Okay.
And so when chapter two was done, I hit pause, went to art school. And while I was in art school, I drew other issues. I skipped ahead to phase 7, number 10. This is a total nightmare. I'm sorry to anyone having to listen to this. It's like George Lucas doing episode 4, 5, and 6. And then 16 years later, going back to 1, 2, and 3. Now they're going ahead 5 years and going back to 7. It's a total mess. Anyways, let's not get into it. I jumped all over the place. I worked on older stuff. And then I came back to Basewood. And basically what it was I was living in New York. was going to art school. There's tons of stuff going on. New York's a great place to live when you're young. And I was just going to museums and hanging out with friends. I became great friends with Aaron Rainier, and we hung out all the time. But I wasn't getting a lot of comics drawn because I was so busy. So yes, I moved to Vermont, the middle of nowhere, and it was very monk-like. And so literally the day I got there, it was August 1st, 2008, I shaved my head. I took a buzzer and cut my hair, and then I bicked it with the, razor, and then my face and everything. And so they were all like, oh, did you hear Alex in town? And then, I'm walking down the street, like looking like a neo-Nazi, and everyone's like, we invited this guy up here.
I don't want to throw you off your story, but I'm just curious about this. Had you ever shaved your head before then?
There was one time, I'm actually drawing a comic about this that's going to come out, but there was like the year 2000. Remember how cool that was? Like party like it's 1999.
Yeah.
So at that New Year's Eve party, I had been growing my hair for a little bit, and I was like, I'll cut my hair.
Okay.
So that was like the closest, but I don't think I shaved it.
Why I was asking was, because I always think the risk is if you cut your hair, you don't know what shape your head is, and you might have really weird dent head or something, but you pulled it off. It looked fine.
Yeah,
but
I have a shapely head.
There's, yeah, you got a good head for that sort of business.
I lucked out. So anyways, and then, so basically when I did that, I was like 8 pages into chapter 3 of Basewood.
Okay.
And that was 2008, August 1st, 2008, and then it went all the way till December 2011. So it was like 3.5 years of not cutting my hair. So by the end, my beard was down to my belly button and my hair was down to the middle of my back.
Which it's kind of fashionable as soon as you decided to cut. The day you did, everyone went, let's all do this.
Yeah,
and by the way, we love your glasses. We're doing that as well.
So when you,
all of us in the world.
When you
right
see
now.
A guy with a giant beard say, oh, how's your graphic novel coming? And he'll look at you like you're crazy.
So with a grain of salt, I'm just doing what's
when you did that, you must have had some, I would say, queer looks and odd reactions and even maybe some negative reactions to how you looked.
Yeah, I had people throw stuff at me from their car and say, nice beard, faggot! And, I was discriminated against the library.
The well-known giant gay beard.
Yeah. Anyways, it was a very difficult. It was actually a really good, that's why I'm drawing a comic about it. It was actually a really good life experience because I learned that people are very judgmental and that someone is not homeless because they have a beard. It might be a religious choice or they might be working on an art project.
Now, more judgment when you look like a skinhead or more judgment when you had the gay beard?
Oh, the beard by far, yeah. People were really, really negative. They react to beards negatively. You just get treated like a... like a person who doesn't have a job and all that kind of stuff.
Well, now you've solved why those Duck Dynasty guys are so homophobic, because they're just trying to like correct the impression that their beard is gay.
Maybe.
That's the thing, it's weird. I mean, it's an odd thing, but I just, when I think about if I had to walk around with a giant mop of hair and a giant beard, people are going to think you're a homeless person or a schizophrenic person or whatever. You don't look like everyone else.
Literally, people crossing the street so that they don't have to pass me on the sidewalk, stuff like that. And then it's like, but it's very strange because from my internal view, I'm just me and I've always looked like this. And literally, you go to the post office and the lady's yelling at you, next in line, what do you want? Oh, I'm trying to send the, and I try to just kill people with kindness. Like, hi, I'm just trying to send this media mail. Well, we can open media mail shipments. And if this isn't a book, then you're going to be in trouble and it's not going to get shipped out. And then I shaved my beard and literally like that, back to normal.
Yeah.
And then you go up to the post office and you say, hi, I'd like to mail this media mail. Okay, honey. Sure. No problem.
No, lady. I'm the beard guy.
I'm the beard guy that you're so mean to last week. Yeah. So it was a good life experience. But what is our catchphrase for Basewood? Never again. Never again. I'm never going to do that again. But it was a good life experience. I don't regret doing it.
You don't regret doing it.
But yeah, so it's 7 years total from start to finish, 2004 to 2011 to draw the book, and then another 3 years of writing before that. So I like to say it's my 20s. You're holding a decade of my life in your hands when you read this book.
That's awesome. Yeah, I bought a copy from you, and you signed it for me, and I'm going to read it. I'm looking forward to it. I have not read it online.
Well, thank you for buying a copy.
I know that it's available, but I'm not a big fan of reading on computers, so...
Yeah, if you want to read it online, it's on my website. You can read the whole thing.
Yeah, we should mention that you have a really good website,
alec-longstreth.com.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that on our website.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And we'll drive 5 people to your...
Perfect.
Site. So, what the heck, hey?
Hey, if anyone's dedicated enough to make it to my website, then I like them.
So
let's, well, you actually, I'm sorry, oops, sorry. When you bought this book, though, you got it slightly discounted because you got it in person. He was like, we're going to sell it for this amount. I'm not going to say how much it was selling for. But like, now that I know it's your 20s and you worked all, I think you should pay the full amount. I feel that's terrible.
I didn't pay a discount. I paid the full amount.
You paid the full amount.
Okay.
In fact, I paid a nickel over cover price.
All right, fine. Okay.
I owe him a nickel.
That's right.
Of my life.
Of my life. I think, each nickel. I should do the math on that.
I feel like the nickel is, you know, is it the autograph? The nickel paid for the little
signing.
Drawing.
Okay.
The drawing,
all right.
And the signing. But so if it's $20 cover price and it's 10 years of my life.
Yes.
So each year of my life is $2. Is that right? Or 50 cents? I can't do
you
that.
Should
yeah,
not.
Your life is worth $2 a year.
$2 a year. That's what I got paid to draw a base with.
You should not think about it that way. Yeah. You should not think about it. So
yeah, don't start your lectures with that.
Yeah.
Welcome to CCS. So how did you end up at CCS? You went to art school in New York. Uh-huh. And which art school was that? That was
Pratt Institute. I was in their illustration program.
Okay.
And so one of my friends in the comics community that I made was Robin Chapman, who was the first fellow at CCS.
Okay.
And James Sturm, who's the president of CCS, mm-hmm. or the, what is he? He's the director. Michelle Olley is the president. And he used to teach at SCAD. So many years ago when he was at Savannah College of Art and Design, Robin was one of his students. So then when he started the school, Robin came up.
Okay.
And so right from the beginning in 2005, Robin said, you should invite Alec and Aaron Rainier.
Yeah.
You guys should invite them up and they could give a talk. So we came up right in 2005. I think we were the second visiting artist at the school.
Great.
One of the first ones. And, so I was involved from then. I used to come up and do the summer workshops and sort of do the occasional lecture. And then in 2008, I was ready to get out of New York City. So I came up as a fellow. And then while I was a fellow, I took over some teaching duties for James. And then I was there for 4 years. Now I live in California. And so I teach remotely. So now they just beam me up on the wall and I yell into Skype and say, do your homework. And all the kids cower.
One kid in the back goes, we've seen this video before. Yeah, it's a live man.
Yeah. Or change the channel. Yeah. So that's working well. And then I'm also going to be teaching at the California College of the Arts. Has a new master's program in comics. So I'll be teaching for them this summer.
Oh, that's great. So I just want to point out, on your website, you have your lecture notes that you did, which is...
Your Comics Will Love You Back.
Your Comics Will Love You Back, which is a really fantastic read. If you want a little bit of inspiration, mm-hmm. if you're stuck on a page, if you're having trouble getting to work on your comics, I really recommend reading Alex. You have two. I think you have two lectures there.
Yeah. The other one is the first one that I did with Aaron, which I think is called For the Love of Comics.
Yeah. And they're both really good. Like, you give lots of nice perspective. I really enjoyed your talking about... production, and you had this thing like, you know, how many people have done one issue of a comic, and it was like 1 million.
trillion people. Yeah. These aren't real numbers. That's what I say. It's like, these are estimates. But yeah, it's a trillion people have done issue one.
I'm one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And then how many people make it to issue two? Cut that in half. It's a billion.
Yeah.
And how many people make it to issue three? Only, you know, 500,000. Yeah. Four. And then you start getting up into, you know, Jeff Smith made it to 55 with Bone, you know.
Is that really? Is that all 55? I thought it was like 100. Wow.
No, 55 issues to get Bone done, and that's,
you know,
say
that's all
100 right. people have yeah. made it that far. And then you look at, you know, John Porcellino's doing issue 75, I think, for the All Maisie issue will be out next year or this year.
Okay.
So that's maybe 10 people have done that.
Yeah.
Then wow. like Dave Sim with Gerhard's help. Let's yeah, not forget Gerhard made forget it Gerhard. To 300.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's like... maybe one of five people that's done that. And then you start getting into God territory, Karl Barks and Tezuka mm-hmm. and Hergé and stuff. And they all had assistants except for Barks. But
Barks did not have assistants.
His wife helped him letter for the last 10 years.
But okay. But I mean, he did in the sense that he had colorists and stuff like that. People
right,
who
right,
worked
right.
on that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Cause yeah, Hergé definitely had assistants. I mean.
Yeah. But I mean, Hergé's assistants was like, draw this car.
Yeah.
Make
yeah,
it accurate.
Yeah.
You know?
To a degree, but someone like Bob D'Amore could pretty much draw like Hergé. I mean, yeah. he could do like, I always think it's. I'm just going to go off on a tangent here.
That's
but
all right.
I always think...
Go on one of your anti-Hergé rants.
It's not anti-Hergé. It's a pro-Hergé. It's maybe an anti-Hergé widow
Dave,
rant.
This is for our Talking Tintin podcast. But go ahead.
I just regret the fact that they didn't let Bob D'Amore draw Tintin and L'Elfe Art. The final... It was scripted, It was started by Hergé.
He can do the style.
He could do the style. Why not just have him finish it?
Yeah.
And then we could have like one more great Hergé Tintin book, you know. And but no, I can see why
he was probably master. He had to put the dots on the eyes. Yeah.
I think, and even there's probably editing that took place during the writing and the drawing and stuff. He probably maybe he was like Chester Brown. He'd cut out panels and put other panels in.
Well,
and
yeah. Like most people don't realize that a lot of the Tintin books are the fourth version of those.
Yeah, he's exactly.
Redrawn them time and time again and refined it. Oh, we should update the technology. This one's ready for a redraw. Jason Lutz, who's a great cartoonist, gives an amazing Tintin lecture at CCS.
Oh, okay.
And he shows earlier versions and how Hergé has corrected sequences to improve flow and increase like the readability.
Oh,
and
stuff. That I would love to see that.
Yeah, it's very interesting stuff.
Well, when I win the lottery, I will fly there to watch his lecture.
You know what I'm going to say? Fly him to you.
Ooh.
You win the lottery. You're talking millions and millions.
And then you could have him on the podcast.
But I could visit White River Junction and see the school.
See the magic.
Oh, that's fine too.
It's basically Hicksville.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's cool. Dylan Horrocks Hicksville. It's full of
in Vermont.
It's that's full of comic books people.
It's a magical place. I love it. It's probably one of my favorite places on earth.
Wow. Can I ask something technical? You're talking about drawing on the giant pieces of paper.
Uh-huh.
When did that change? Or are you still...
No. So as soon as I finished Basewood, I put down my pen and I said, never again.
So you did all of Basewood on those?
Yeah, 204 pages at that size.
Oh, my dear Lord.
And the cover. So okay. 206 pages.
All right.
And then never again. And then when I finished that, so I mean, you know, think about 18 by 24. If you quartered that, you'd have a 9 by 12 page. So if I worked at 9 by 12, I could have, instead of 200 pages, I'd have 800 pages.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't think about it.
Yeah, I'm not going to think about it. But I do think about it because now I draw 11 by 14. Mm-hmm. Which is what I was drawing before I did Basewood.
Yeah.
But the main thing is that I've learned to draw small. so now I feel comfortable at a smaller size and my output is faster. I'm happier, more productive.
I'm finding, I got a friend named, he goes under the name Moritat, but he does a lot of mainstream stuff and also some European stuff. And he started drawing on postcards and he draws that small and then blows it up and then inks over that. Does his finished work. And I'm like, well, how can you possibly draw it this size? But my wife has tried it as well. It's like, it's easier than you think. And it takes a lot of the pressure off. When you've got something that small, it's like, screw it up. Who cares?
Yeah, you know? And I've just been seeing a trend where like people do this. I mean, it kind of gets back to what you were saying, David, where someone takes, you know, a really detailed style on their first project and then they kind of veer away from that as they realize how time intensive, like someone like Drew Wang did Set to Sea, which is beautifully cross-hatched and rendered and everything's, you know, this sort of amazing stuff. And then he just started his webcomic, The Mysterious Files of Margot Malou.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a very pared down, controlled kind of open line style. And, you know, he's got a limited color palette that's helping him not have to cross-hatch because he can just drop in the purple or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of a trend you see with a lot of cartoonists where, you know, I sort of dread if people are like, I love Basewood because I'm never going to draw anything like it ever again. So I hope when my new stuff comes out, I don't get a lot of like, why don't you crosshatch it or whatever.
Well, in a way, you're lucky, though, because you jumped ahead with Phase 7. You kind of introduced like a newer style even while you were doing Basewood. So Basewood's kind of like a throwback to what you're drawing. And when you were doing, I guess, the transition stories and stuff like that, you had a totally different
style
for those.
Yeah, and then to sort of compound that feeling, it's like I put my pen down in December 2011, and then it's like, you know, I shopped the book around, nobody wanted to publish it, and then I moved to California, my wife got cancer, so I was dealing with all this stuff, and so like by the time the book did, and then I did Kickstarter, which took a lot of time, and like by the time I did finally get the book, like now is when it's kind of new and out. But it's 3 years old to me. Like, even if you just think of it in terms of, you know, in the last 2 years, I basically had my 50s guy in my brain was holding a gun to the outside of my brain. I don't know. Was saying, work, Longstreth, work. And I just didn't want to do it because I was like, I'm so sick of this style. I don't want to draw this way anymore, but I got to keep it consistent. So, you know, for me, the book is maybe like 5 years old. You know, it's new to other people. So I have to kind of jump back into it and get excited about it.
I would feel so sorry for someone who was locked into a style that they established and it became popular and then, I got to keep doing it, even though that's your 20s style. Like, you are growing and maturing, and as an artist, you should be changing.
Yeah,
but I'm like, no, I better go. Got to do the cross hatching. That's my thing.
Right. Yeah, I had to go back and even retouch some of the earlier chapters for the final book, just because I had grown so much. You know, even trying to stick with the same style, you just have a more refined line, and you sort of know your characters better and stuff. So I cleaned some things up so that it feels consistent.
Interesting. Yeah, it's. I'm just thinking about that because, you know, obviously you do have people like Tintin who improved immeasurably as an artist from when you look at, like, the Land of the Soviets, you know, very, very rough style. And then you know, jump ahead 5 years. It's just amazing the amount of improvement in drawing style, but just from everyday working. But then there's other people. I'm just thinking of French artists for some reason, but then there's Peyo, who did the Smurfs and Johan and Pierre-Louis. The Shrimps. And, his style never changed.
Right.
Like,
you know, just had it right off the bat.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, there was a slight improvement. If you look at the early Johan and Pierre-Louis, there's, you know, everything's kind of longer, and he learned to, things are funnier and more interesting when they're kind of squished and a little broader. But, the style basically remained the same. He never really, like, changed. Like, someone like Franquin, you know, they constantly changed and updated their style. And
Some people, I think, they're just kind of locked in. You know, at CCS, we had, like, there's a weekly visiting artist that always comes through.
Okay.
And Charles Burns came, and we're all like, oh, my God, this is going to be amazing. And his slideshow was like, oh, here's something I did in college. And it's just like, you know, it's like a laser perfect Charles Burns drawing. You're like, that's your college stuff? And, you know, so I've just been drawing like this for a while, and I kind of use the same brush or whatever. And it's like, all right, from day one, he was Charles Burns and
you
know, had his stuff lined up.
I was looking at a process post that he did of doing a cover for something. I think it's for a magazine. It was kind of like a concert, a rock concert scene, if I remember correctly. And what was most interesting to me about it was how terribly rough it was. The beginning parts of it were, because I always imagined him drawing like really
tight pencils.
Yeah, tight pencils and everything like that, but it was really loose. It was more the inks that were tight than the pencils. Yeah. But I guess he's gotten to the point now where inking and all that is second nature for him, because that
guy kind of knows what he's doing.
I think so. Yeah, he's kind of got to that point. So, we can talk about two things. Let's talk about Weezer first.
Let's talk about Weezer.
Because this is your all-time favorite band.
Yes.
Without a doubt. Why are they just hit that sweet spot of your youth?
Yeah, I was like 15 and my sister was home from college and she was like, oh, I'm getting rid of these CDs. You know, let me know if you want any of these. And I sort of flipped through and I was like, oh, I feel like I've heard of these guys. And then when I put it on, it changed my life forever.
Okay.
I was just like, oh my God.
So it was the Blue Album, Red Album, Pinkerton.
Pinkerton. Do you listen to music, by the way, when you work?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm pretty much listening to stuff all day long, and it sort of shifts as I go through the day. So if I'm scripting in the morning, I can listen to music, but I can't have any lyrics. So I usually listen to jazz. And then when I shift over to penciling, I can listen to any kind of music. And then when I ink, I can listen to like stuff with actual talking, like audiobooks or podcasts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So...
interesting.
Yeah.
So you've started, you've had some experiences with Weezer. You got to do some artwork for them,
I think? Yeah, I did two posters for the Memories Tour.
Okay.
I'm working on a 3-issue arc of Phase 7, and it's called Weezer Fan.
Yeah.
And it's sort of about, I'm not going to say it's not about Weezer, because it is very much about Weezer.
Yeah.
But my hope is that anyone would be able to read it, and you could take whatever your favorite band is.
Yeah.
For instance, if two gentlemen happen to like the Beatles, you could read it and be like, oh man, this sort of reminds me of what it was like to be a teenager, hear the Beatles for the first time, get really excited about it, and sort of want to share that with the world. And so the first issue is kind of the first infatuation. Second issue is the first show where they came to Seattle, where are we? That way. At the Seattle Center at the Deviate Club in 1997.
We're set the scene. We're at the W Hotel right now.
Yeah.
In downtown Seattle.
Well, I should also mention there's three women in the room trying to get some sleep. And are being
patient
with us. Very surprised that we're doing a podcast.
Yeah.
So a couple of blocks from here.
Yeah. So just over the hill over there, I saw them. That was my first rock concert ever. Okay. You know, I was like, Mom, can I please take the car? I promise I won't crash it. And, you know, so I drove over there. We saw the show. I got to meet the band. We were there like 6 hours early, so we saw the van pull up and they came out and talked to us. Rivers Cuomo signed my guitar after the show. It was probably the happiest moment of my life, and then it's been all downhill ever since then. And then in the third part, it's sort of like seeing them over many years, and basically the best part about being a Weezer fan is they have this guy Carl Cook, who's their sort of like the fifth member of Weezer. He's not actually in the band, but like who's the guy for the Beatles?
Well, I guess, who's the fifth Beatle?
I would say if you're the George guy you're thinking would be Neil Aspinall.
Oh, Neil Aspinall. That's exactly what I'm thinking. He is their Neil Aspinall. So he like drove the van and he was the guitar tech for a couple years, but he also does photography and he sort of, you know, documents the band and all that kind of stuff. And he's a huge comics fan.
Okay.
And so he has a niece named Fallon Cook.
Okay.
And so she would talk to me and I was like, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. But like Cook is kind of a common last name, K-O-C-H. So I never put two and two together. And then one time she was like, oh, you're into Weezer? Like, my uncle works with them. And I was like, your uncle is Paul Cook? Oh, my God. Blah. I was like, I'm in the fan club. There's no way. And she was like, oh, you should email him. You know, he would put you backstage or whatever. So she sort of put me in touch with him. And I started sending him Phase 7 and saying I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
And then they were doing this Memories tour where they did the Blue Album in Pinkerton.
Yeah.
So they hired me to draw posters for the band. So again, I got to go backstage. And then like as an adult, I got to at the show in Vermont. They came to Vermont. It wasn't actually the New York show, but, they came to Vermont. I was like, hey, Carl, I'm going to be at the show. And he's like, I'll put a backstage pass for you. So I watched the show from on stage. And then after the show, he was like, just hang out. Don't leave. Just hang out. And so everyone was kind of leaving and I was just standing there with a couple other fans. And then we got to go in like the inner circle to Rivers' tour bus, and he came off and like had an audience, and I just poured my heart out in his face. I was like, "Your music means so much to me, man!" And I, you know, like, don't listen to the haters. Just keep making music. I love you. I'm always gonna buy every Weezer. You know, say I'm your biggest fan, and you know, I listen to your music all day long while I'm drawing, and you know, you mean so much to me. And he was like, "Wow, thanks, man. Woo!" You know.
I just want to point out that Alec was making the rock fingers. He's doing rock fingers.
And then he said, what haters are you talking about? Oh, you know, all the people online. What? I'm not familiar with what sites are you talking about?
I thought everyone loved us.
Meanwhile,
Carl Cook is back going, no, he's waving his hands.
He's not aware. We've just told him about email. That's all he knows exists.
Doesn't know about the internet.
Yeah, so it's been, I don't know. I mean, I'm just like, I can't say it enough. It's actually a quote from the Blue Album when they're doing the party scene on the Sweater song and everyone's like, oh, hey, man, do you hear about that party later? And this one guy says, oh, yeah, man, life is so rad. And that's just how I feel. Like, I've gotten to meet all my heroes.
Yeah.
I'm doing what I love. I make a living sitting in a room and drawing and sharing my love of that skill with other people. And so like, yeah, Weezer is just like the message of that whole story is just that dreams come true. It's like, I got to work with my favorite band. I've got to hang out backstage with them. Like, what more could you want? So life is good.
Awesome.
That is really great. So, okay, well, let's radically change.
Let's go from life is good.
Life is good.
Like, really, that is where we should end the podcast.
I know.
We've got 20 minutes to fill.
It gets even better.
Oh, boy. Okay, wait a second.
Let's say, for instance, that you were into something like, I'm just picking something out of the air. I don't know. Pinball. Okay.
Okay.
What if you owned your own pinball machine? That's how awesome life could be.
I got two goals. Like, Dave is a homeowner right now.
Congratulations on your mortgage.
I don't know how things are going to be. But the kind of dream for me and my wife is, when we get a house, first thing, going to get a dog, because we can get a dog.
Good work.
And then we're going to get a pinball machine in the basement.
Man cave, right?
Well, no, because she'll be playing it too.
Okay.
No,
pinball machine.
You know what? That's the 1950s guy in your head talking. Ladies enjoy a pinball machine.
Sorry, sweetheart.
Let me wake up these three women in the room. Hey, you like pinball, right? We're all like, no, pretty much.
We're getting a lot of shaking hands.
50s guy had it right. Okay, my mistake.
So if you could get any pinball machine, which pinball machine would you get?
You know what?
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's a good one.
That is a good one. I'm going to go.
Don Rosa owns that machine.
I'm going to go with the Addams Family. I'm going to go with the Addams Family.
Okay.
One. I like the magnetic center. Yeah, yeah. I like that business. Mm-hmm. I'd go with a Pinbot probably.
Pinbot's fun. Yeah.
Pinbot. I enjoy a Ms. Pinbot or whatever the Mrs. Pinbot.
Right.
Lady Pinbot. What is it? What is?
We don't know. You should know it. You're the one who was lecturing us about how women like pinball machines. You should know this stuff.
Well, this is a female pinball machine. This is not a thing. No, oh man, I love pinball so much. Like that is my dream basement. Like I don't drink, but I would like a bar and I would like a pinball machine, and then I don't care what the rest. The
bar,
whatever.
Yeah. You can serve soft drinks at your bar. You don't need to.
Shirley Temples or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Like a Shirley Temple.
Ginger ale.
But I used to, when I was 11, there was a bowling alley that I used to go to, and it had like all the pinball machines.
Mm-hmm.
And I would waste every dime I had there. Well, a quarter. I would waste every quarter I had
there. Well, so in my experience, everyone has a story like that, where like, oh man, I had this one summer, and there was a laundromat, yep. and in the back, there was a pinball machine. And
it was
so,
that, and there was a movie theater next door that showed not the right movies. Like, we're going to see Pinocchio, but it wasn't that Pinocchio. It was European Pinocchio, where like, kids are being boiled alive. It's like, what's this?
They're tricking you into coming into the theater.
It's not Born Free. It's another one, but they're throwing rocks at a cougar. Anyway, so, and then, yeah, we'd go always play pinball afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, that didn't actually happen until I was in Vermont.
Yeah.
And I, another great teacher at CCS is John Chad, who's a great mini comics guy. He's done Bike Man and he's got a new book coming out from Ad House called Bobo Backslack, The Bad Ventures of Bobo Backslack. And he and I were doing the CCS summer workshops and we were going to have a picnic, but it was raining. And so we went into this little pool hall that was right on Main Street. And I'm a huge Star Wars fan. And so in the corner, there was a Star Wars logo and I was just like, you know, like I had instant, I could see it. And I was like, what is that over there? And it was this Star Wars pinball machine. And we were, but it's the, if anyone's familiar, there's Pinball 2000, which was sort of this last ditch effort to save pinball before it died in 1999. And it's this bizarre sort of contraption. It's like half video game, half pinball.
Yeah.
And it sort of projects the video screen onto the playfield. So you're actually hitting video elements with a physical pinball. It's really cool. And so we were like, what is this thing? We couldn't really figure it out. We put a couple quarters in it. And that's when we had, you know, and then that summer we played pinball every day for the rest of the summer. We just got really into it. And we're both zinesters. So we thought, hey, let's make a zine. And there used to be a zine in the 90s called Multiball, which is one of the big zines.
Okay.
It broke big. It was like, you know, 10,000 issues or 10,000 copies per issue, you know, and they would put it out in Tower Records.
That's no longer a zine, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a mega zine. But so we sort of passed the torch. We actually tracked down the people that used to do that zine. We did an interview with them for our first issue. And then we do Dream Machines. So we try and make like... you know, like make up a pinball machine that doesn't exist. So for each issue, I do a Harry Potter machine. I take the next book in the Harry Potter series and turn it into a pinball machine.
Oh, that's a good idea.
We do comics about pinball, sort of our journey in. Eventually, John and I both bought machines. So then,
what do you have? Sorry.
I have a Medieval Madness.
Gotcha. Love it. Okay.
And he bought a Jurassic Park, which is like the Data East knockoff of Adam's Family. Same layout. And so, but then your pinball machines break. So then like issue three is about fixing your pinball machine, or, you know, sort of getting deeper and deeper into the community, going to comic conventions, you know, like right now we're at Emerald City Comic Con. There's these same kinds of things, but they're for pinball and it's just a giant room with 300 pinball machines in it. So we've been to a couple of those and then like tournaments and, just moving right up the chain. Eventually we did some work for Stern Pinball. We do some blogging for them. And so John actually got to go when he was in Chicago, he got to go on the Stern campus and like get a tour of the factory where they build pinball machines, and he got to interview some of the designers there. So that's our next issue, is the design issue.
Oh, interesting.
But, that's a side project that John and I do to share our passion of pinball, is Drop Target Zine.
If you ever get a chance to go to HalCon, the Halifax con, they have three floors, and the bottom floor is like games, and the middle floor is comics, mostly alternative stuff, and then some celebrities. Top floor, free pinball.
What?
It was just like, and
I'll be there.
It was insane. I know. And like, people didn't know it. Like, they thought, well, no, we're done. This is it. And they didn't really advertise it. But you go up there, and there's, like, just free.
Wow.
And just, you're just playing free pinball. Like, how can this exist? And people would come in and go, what's the catch? What's wrong? This can't be possible.
Looking over your shoulder.
You are. Yeah. You're like, I feel like I should put a quarter down. Should I just tip? What do you – oh, it's beautiful.
That's great.
So nice. Well, I'd like to, by the way, change my answer on the Addams Family.
Okay.
I do like the Addams Family very much.
Yeah.
But there's a weird one. Though I can't, I've never found it since college. The baby Pac-Man game.
Oh yeah, where there's a video screen above.
Yes, when you were talking about the
they have one in Seattle at Shorty's, 222 Second Avenue. You can play baby Pac-Man tonight.
What the hell? Why are we here?
It's in Belltown. You could walk there from here.
Yeah, the deal was you would like shoot the ball up. And then it would go up into the video game, and you would play as baby Pac-Man, and then go back down, and now you're the ball.
I remember that one.
It's within a mile's walk from where we sit right now. So.
Shorty's is the name.
Shorty's. You can't miss it.
Damn it. I hate being here right now.
And then we didn't see Ian for the rest of Emerald City Comic Con.
Right. If it wasn't for me having to wake up the three women on the way out, I would leave right now. Oh, no.
They're sleeping in front of the door. Yeah, I think the reason I like Creature from the Black Lagoon is actually I'm terrible at pinball. I have like the worst timing in the world, or as Ian calls it, timing. Because I just cannot push the flippers at the right time. But for some reason, we were on the ferry going from Vancouver to Victoria in British Columbia, and it's about a 2.5 hour trip,
about
I guess.
About that, yeah.
And we played, the whole time we played Creature from the Black Lagoon at the pinball game. And I was actually like, great. For the first time in my life, I was like, my timing was perfect.
But you know why? Because we were on a boat. Yeah, the boat was rocking. And it was like nothing to do with you. Yeah. It just like whooped
the wave. Every time you were about to drain, the boat went.
Probably. Yeah, everyone else is throwing up on the ship. It's their worst trip ever.
I was
kidding. David's going, it's weird. I usually suck, but I'm having a great game.
The whole time I had a great game. It lasted forever. Wow. It's a really good game.
Sometimes a vortex opens up and you just have the game of your life, and that is the best feeling in the world. My dad has a great story like that where my dad's a doctor. Sure. He works here in Seattle, and he had just finished his last like test for medical school or something, the boards or something, some really stressful 8-hour test.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of the medical students all go to the bar, and they're like, oh, man, that was killer. And my dad's like, go play a game of pinball. So he drops a quarter, and he's in the perfect Zen mindset. You know, he's not putting any pressure on it. He's just kind of going with the flow. And like you're saying, he just had this game where, like, the vortex opens up, and he plays for hours, you know, just, like, gets, like, 3 credits. And everyone's like, wow, you know, look at Will. He's really good at playing. He's, you know, just playing and playing and playing. And then, you know, finally the ball drains. And then a week later, he's like, you know, I got an hour to kill. I'll go play a game of pinball because, you know, now I'm really good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you put a quarter in, drain, you know, put another quarter in, drain. He just couldn't get anything going. So
it's kind of like golf in that way, I guess, whereas you have these little moments of a perfect game. And that's what keeps people playing golf.
You're chasing the dragon.
You have that one round where you hit par, you hit near par, and then you're chasing forever after, the next 5 years, this is absolute garbage.
I'm picturing your dad playing that one, like Dr. Awesome. I just remember this, like, it was a very 80s game, and it was
Dr. Dude.
Was it Dr. Dude? That's Dr. right, Dude, yeah. I just picture him playing that.
Like, maybe. Like except this was in probably the 70s or the
60s. Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah, we have a pretty good arcade, Movie Land Arcade in Vancouver.
Yeah.
But occasionally, for some reason, the wiring gets weird, and you're playing the game, and like, I'm getting an electrical charge through me.
Ooh, yeah,
I wonder how much
good.
Of this is safe. Yeah. And then like a friend of mine touched two at the same time, like, and was like, he really got like shocked back. I was like, okay, you shouldn't do that. I'm really doing well on this game.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Risking electrocution to have a good game of pinball.
It's because you're melding with the machine.
Yeah.
You and the machine are one. That's what you're feeling. It's nothing. You're not being electrocuted. You are just joining with the machine together. You've played that long, Ian.
You're becoming the pinbot.
You're becoming the pinbot. Pretty soon, your whole life will be.
Wait, I'm becoming Ms. Pinbot.
Hey, Ian, we're going to get going. I am the pinbot.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I love video games, but there's something about the pinball itself.
Yeah, the physical element.
It's tactile. And for me, like, I've always, I don't know, like, I think we all have that dream where it's like, I want to get so good someday that I can just walk in and it's like, oh, Pac-Man, you know, and just get to the kill screen and everyone's like, whoa, who is that guy? And set the high score that's going to be up there for 10 years, you know, that no one will ever touch. But I'm not good at video games. My parents didn't let me have a Nintendo, so I never built that skill set.
Yeah.
But pinball, you know, if you can get the manipulation of the ball with two flippers, it's the same on every pinball. Every modern pinball has the same setup. So if you're good at that, you're good at all of them. So I just got back from the Angoulême Festival in France, and there's this one bar, Kennedy's, that always has flipper, as they call it, which is pinball. And so we went over there, and they're like, oh, Alec's really good. And, you know, I had a couple bad games. But then the vortex opened, and I just, like, blew it open, got, like, 3 multi-balls on one ball, and everyone's like, oh, my God, you know, and you're setting the high scores.
Mon Dieu.
It feels good. Mon Dieu.
We call him Monsieur Flipper from now. Monsieur Flipper. The legend of Monsieur Flipper.
Le flipper américain.
And I said, yeah, Delion.
How do we do this? You do it 16 hours a day.
Yeah,
make sure. You have to have take short breaks.
You have to have one in your living room. That's the key.
You do it for 3 hours in the morning, have an hour break. Then you do it for another 2 hours, have a 3-hour break.
I wonder, like, with like the movie, you said King of Kong, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I wonder, like, King of Kong, if that turned more people on to that or turned more people off to that.
I don't know. I've played at that arcade, though.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. It's in Weirs Beach, New Hampshire, which is not far from CCS. It's about an hour and a half drive. So we've reported at it. It's one of our pinholes, I think, on our website.
Oh, nice. I just loved people gathering around and watching a person play a video game.
Yeah.
Like, that's something from my past that does not exist now
yeah.
at all.
Yeah.
People do not gather. You do not put a yeah. quarter on the machine. Down. You don't do any Watch of that the guy. Stuff.
Well, yeah, because there's some skill there.
The best pinball town, I think, in America is Portland, Oregon. And that culture is very alive and well. I mean, there are pinball machines and laundromats, bars. Every pinball machine in Portland is on location. Like, there are none, for the operators at least, that are, you know, not out on location. And, wow. like, I've been in bars where I have a good game, and you're just kind of in the zone, and then you look up, and someone will pat you on the back. Man, that was an awesome game. And he's been watching you for half an hour or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So. Oh, that was a part of the fun of it. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I remember when we were kids, we would go to a resort town called Osoyoos in B.C., it was kind of a, it was sort of in a, the only desert in Canada. So uh-huh. it was kind of a beach kind of resort. But there was a laundromat that had, you know, bottled Coke and stuff like that. And then it also had this old pinball machine. It was, yeah,
of course.
That's the thing. And all the kids would be standing around in their bathing suits, watching each other
right.
playing pinball when we should have been at the lake swimming. But, you know, we'd be wow. in this place. Hey, when, the, you know, it got hot out, it was, yeah, you know, it was yeah. nice to get out of the sun for a while.
Well, and there's sort of that primitive thing, the knock. You know, if you can get the replay, if you get the high enough score, it goes, you know, and everyone in the bar kind of looks over and goes, "Whoa, that guy knows what he's doing with that machine." So that's
he's
a very
got his life together.
Dance. Yeah, dude, he's got a patient wife.
Now I'm sure you're too young for this, but maybe someone's told you about it. There used to be a game show called The Great Marble Machine or something.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Never. Okay, here's the deal behind it. Stupid game show bullshit off the top, and then like the winners get to play a gigantic pinball machine.
Whoa, cool!
Like a pinball machine, literally as big as the room we're in, which doesn't help you guys out there. But imagine a hotel room that big. That's how big it was. And it was my favorite show in
cool.
the world.
Cool. Like, I'm gonna look that up.
Like, I wonder, like, to this day, what did they do with that machine?
Yeah.
You know, are the parts still in existence? Like the second. We used to, at the Pacific National Exhibition in Vancouver, they used to have a giant pinball machine, not that size, of course. But, yeah, I used to play that one to death as well.
Yeah.
You ever play a giant pinball machine?
Yeah, there was one at the Pacific Pinball Expo. I'm trying to think what it's called. It's like a gigantic one. Like, instead of a pinball, the ball is a pool cue.
Yeah.
And the flippers are like 6 inches long.
And it looked like it was a caveman or something.
Yeah,
like,
it's like Conan the Barbarian
type
sort of
deal.
Theme.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I forget
and it's
what
not
it's
a great game. Like, physically, it's not a great game. The one on the game show was. That was excellent. And then you'd have to hit certain things. And then if you hit the right things, you get the car. And if you hit the this, you hit the that.
That sounds great.
Yep. I will try and send you
Let's reboot that, Hollywood.
No kidding.
We're
get
ready.
On it.
That's right.
Pinball's hot in America and North America, I should say. Sorry, Canada.
No, it's okay. We're in your land right now, and we're respecting you.
Okay,
Dave's also
American. I'm going to TCAF. I'm down with the Canadians. Someone on the Comics Journal said, Canadian cartoonist Alec Longstreth, his new book Basewood is out this week, and someone emailed me and said, are you Canadian? And I said, no.
You do have a beard.
I do have a beard.
So there you go. Case closed.
Close enough.
That's right. Case close enough. No, you just mentioned you went to Angoulême, which is the French comics festival in France, which makes sense. It's French.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting because when I was growing up and comics were looked down upon by every single person on earth, you dreamt of France as like the place, right? Bande dessinée. You know, I actually read them on the trains there, you know, like the
ninth art.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, whereas here, you know, they got dumped on and their art. So you went to Angoulême.
Yeah. I mean, it's still that way. I still feel that way.
Yeah.
I woke up on the last day of Angoulême and with the time change, I was looking at Twitter. And everyone was like, oh, Super Bowl, Seattle won the Super Bowl. My friends from high school like, Seattle, woo. And it's just crazy because I looked
up. The horns came out again, by the way, the rock and roll horns.
Right. But I looked up the stats. If you take all the people that were in the stadium at the Super Bowl, it's 80,000 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if you take the number of people that came to Angoulême, it's 250,000 people.
Wow.
Okay. So.
Okay,
and then if you do,
you're kind of skewing the figures because you're missing out the TV audience for the Super Bowl. That's
right.
Okay.
But let's just talk about it. Like, if you take that number, 250,000 people, and you divide it. So I was doing all this math in bed and like posting this on Twitter. You can go back to my Twitter feed. I was like, if you take that and compare it to the population of France, it's 0.3%, 0.03, you know, like of a percent of the population of France. So if you take that and you apply it to America, and we had a show that was at the scale of Angoulême, it would be 1 million people at a show. And like San Diego gets what, like 50,000 people or something, 80,000 people. I don't know the exact number.
Yeah, it's probably more than 100,000, but yeah, 100,000. Now big deal.
Yeah,
big deal,
so it'd be 10 times bigger than that if we cared about comics as much as the French.
And I mean, to be, San Diego is probably...
San Diego's not about comics.
It's not about comics anymore. Yeah, it's more of it's a multimedia. Yeah,
movies and toys and whatever. Yeah. So, I mean, they really respect it over there. And when you're signing books and you're talking to people, it's not just fanboys.
Yeah.
You know, it's like old women and young kids. And everyone reads comics there. And it's just amazing.
We went to Paris earlier this year. My wife, and she was a guest and I was the tag along. But yeah, it was a gigantic book fair. And a lot of it was comics.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. Like all ages. And then the president showed up and he was in some trouble and he was going, I might be arrested tomorrow. Ha ha. And he was joking around and he was reading comics and then he left and was like, all right.
Is that Sarkozy? Was it?
It could be. Okay. I'm not sure. I didn't ask him his name because he seemed
busy. President showed up. I mean, Barack Obama's not going to roll into San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, he's not. Well, not even Comic-Con. He's not showing up at the book fair.
Right.
Like, other people look at the intellectual.
SPX, which is down the road. He could actually be there. But,
yeah, it could be. Yeah. But yeah, there's something different though about France for sure. Yeah. They've got they've got a deeper tie to culture in general.
Right.
Yeah. And if something's good, it's good. Well, what is it? I don't care if it's good graffiti. It's good.
Yeah.
Is it good comics? It's good. It's good food. We'll eat it.
Yeah, but I mean, I had this sort of it was sort of inspiring, but also kind of upsetting experience while I was there because they have this museum, the Museum of Comics, Musée de Bande Dessinée.
All right.
And I went through the exhibit, and half the comics in there are from Americans.
Really? Right?
It's Wizard McKay, and they're like, look, you know, R. Crumb and all this stuff. Like, these are important cartoonists, not just to American comics, but to comics in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I have to travel to France to see this art form that I love in a beautiful world-class museum facility. And it's like, you know, we have some. There's the comic art museum in San Francisco. There's the Billy Ireland one in Ohio that I really want to get out to and check out. But it was like, wow, you know, we've contributed so much to this art form. But I have to go to France to appreciate that.
Yeah.
And then later I went to Brussels and went to their comics museum. And they had a Will Eisner exhibit that was the size of the other comics museums in the U.S. You know, it's like this gigantic display showing, you know, 50 years of Eisner's work.
Wow.
Really treated with respect. And it's like, why do I have to come to Brussels to see this thing? We would never have that exhibit
because
U.S.
Because they have art galleries. Period.
Right.
And so it goes from there. I mean, we went to Gion once, and I was one of the guests there. And they're having a presentation. We didn't know what was going to go on. And me and my friend James Lloyd, we were brought on stage. Like, well, now draw for us. Okay. So we're drawing in front of a really big audience. And
they're rapt attention, right?
Right. But then they bring out a Piper band and they're doing and we're the thing that they're doing. And then they hang that up in a gal. And it's like, what the?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess this is the way you do it. But at least in France, I know if you try to close a gallery, people will riot in the streets.
Right.
You know, they, you know.
Unless it's the people who work in the gallery, then it's okay for them to close it down.
That
happened to us in Paris. We couldn't go to Pompidou one day because it was closed by the staff striking.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, art galleries, it feels there, are something you would go to.
Yeah.
Right.
You would, or at least you'd be aware of and be exposed to and have gone through them in your life. But like in North America, it feels like, we got an art gallery in our city. Like, do you go to it? I don't know.
Where is it?
Yeah. Some Da Vinci thing's going on there, I guess. Maybe I'll, I don't know. You know, it doesn't have any connection with your life.
Yeah.
So you need something to build on, and then you can throw comics on top of it. But
I don't know. I came back from that trip and I was sort of on one hand heartened to like, man, I want to get better. You know, I said to all my American friends that were at the show, I said, we got to go home. We got to get better. We got to draw comics so good that no one can ignore them. But then on the other hand, it's like, who am I kidding? You know, they have this small country and it's sort of easier to have passion about something, whereas like North America, I mean, what we're up against
the
trillions
vast,
of miles, square miles of whatever, it's like so spread out and how do you connect with that many people?
The one thing I find that is nice is it is nice, and I'm gonna cuss everyone who's sleeping. It's nice to be working in the land of don't give a fuck. You know, and then you can go to the land of give a fuck later and go, oh, people give a fuck here. How lovely this is.
Yeah.
But you know, no one cares, you know, in your hometown.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any published books in America. I'm all self-published here. And over there, I have two books out, and I look like this impressive author.
Right.
And I do book signings in Paris, and people line up to have me sign their book. So,
wow.
Feels cool to me.
Exactly. And then, I think that's kind of healthy. You don't want, like, people gathering at your window wanting to watch you work.
Right.
You know, that'd be very, very strange. You want anonymous and then famous somewhere else. That seems to be ideal.
But yeah, if I could go to Angoulême for the next, you know, every five years for the rest of my career, that would make me very happy.
Yeah.
Get some good food and some appreciation and boost the old ego, you know, pump some hot air in there, feel pretty good, come and home and just
send you back. You tell all your friends what's what again. Listen again, guys.
And then stand at Emerald City Comic Con for 4 hours and not sell a single book. So that's good. That's good.
Hey, you sold the book to me.
That's true.
I broke the streak.
Yeah. For a nickel less than. So is there anything else before we
think no, I think
touched we've touched on everything.
We've covered the pinball. We've covered France and why they're better than us.
Yes. We covered Alex with Tar and Feathers.
That's right.
Yes.
And I think everyone in this room needs to get some sleep. So we're just going to let them do that. And let me say, it was really nice of you to do this.
Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely. And you and I like that when you were asking, when did you want to do it? And you did the old now. And you put us on our heels, mister. So
how about right now? There was 50s boss in my head.
Yeah, I was like, let's do it right now.
We're not used to 50s boss.
Yeah.
We do podcasting.
Yeah, we're scared. All right, let's just set it up, fellas.
Yeah, I had to run back to the hotel. And
yeah, you really called us on our bluff.
Thank you guys for
bluff.
Being so accommodating.
None of this stuff is plugged in.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's a self pretend.
Yeah, there's a band down the hall that is missing a lot of equipment.
Right.
The mariachi band here at the W.
That's right.
They play downstairs in the, for breakfast. The mariachi breakfast here.
Yeah, it's, you're trying to drink your coffee. You're hungover from partying at Emerald City Comic Con. And then.
It's not quite the complimentary. Spanish
pipers. No, don't worry. It's complimentary. That's complimentary. No, no charge.
We're going to play the Lonely Bull.
Yeah.
Okay. So things that websites that should be gone to and books that should be purchased.
All right.
Where should they be bought? And because it's good to say top.
Okay. So alec-longstreth.com. That's my website. You can buy all my stuff there. If you're into the pinball stuff, it's droptargetzine.blogspot.com. Good
sounds
luck
like
with
you're
that.
Making it up.
But okay. It links for my other site. Just put drop target zine, you'll get it.
Yeah, I was going to say if you Google it.
And I think that's it. Cartoonstudies.org if you want to learn more about the Center for Cartoon Studies. Go get your master's degree. We've had a couple Canadian students and fellows. We welcome our northern brethren.
Well, you're pretty far north there anyway.
Yeah,
so
it's
you better...
not far. It's like 2 hours to Quebec or whatever. So.
And we'll have links to all that on our website, sneakydragon.com.
Yes, we will.
So please go on there and do all the things that you normally do. You know how the internet works. We're not telling you nothing.
Vaguely.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks. Thank you very much for listening. And France, if you're listening, invite him back.
Yeah.
Invite him like every 5 years or so. The guy needs
S'il vous plaît.
Please. All right. So I've been Ian Boothby.
I've been David Dedrick.
I'm Alec Longstreth.
And this has been Sneaky Dragon. Thank you for listening.
Thanks.
Back off, man.